For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Mosaic law, prosaic law, civil law, natural law, moral law, 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 law. That's our subject for today in the Catholic Cave.
Well, la-di-da.
I'm Kent Blanford. That was the voice of...
Mark Tuttle. I'm sorry, I'm Tim.
No.
That was Tim O'Donnell. Let's put the blame where it belongs. That's what the law would tell us to do.
Whoa.
And... sitting opposite me also, Mr. Mark Tuttle. Gentlemen, today we're talking law in all its varieties, in all its...
majesty.
Majesty, all its flavors, and, you know...
all its flaws.
There are those, too.
Right.
So where do we go for advice, for expertise, when we need to talk about the law?
We are talking about the law because we are urgently waiting for our special guest today, who is none other than a judge himself. So, in a few minutes, we will be able to sit down and discuss the law. But I think the reason why we want to talk law is because so often it looks like there's a conflict. It looks like there's a great conflict between what's going on at our state house and legislature, and really
common
sometimes there's a conflict between common sense.
Too cynical already.
But let's take one of the bills that has gone through the legislature right now is a bill to open up Sunday sales for alcohol.
Yes, and I've been wanting to talk about this.
Lots of different opinions on it. Lots of different thoughts around it. You know, whether it makes sense, whether it's protecting, whether it's protecting the interests of one particular industry or not. You know, all sorts of reasons. Mm-hmm. But the irony is, the thing that never gets brought up is the reason we had that law to begin with.
Correct.
Which the reason we had that law to begin with was in part to protect the Sabbath. To protect the idea of honoring the Sabbath, which is about as religious an idea as you can get.
Well, that's one of the Ten Commandments.
Yeah, there you come down to the basic 10 laws by which Western civilization has developed.
Right, right. And I guess you could come up with secular reasons as to why it's important to have a day set aside for rest, for family, a day set aside where, you know, we're really not supposed to work, although we've, as a society, have completely gotten away from that idea. That might be a topic for another show.
Although Poland is restoring it, but again, that time for another show on that.
Right, exactly. But the point for this show, at least, is there used to be a great compatibility between religious practice and civil practice. These were not seen as two sort of incompatible, incongruent spheres where we had civil law and daily life and our legislature and the laws that we live in, you know, secular society, and then we had religious practices and religious laws, and the two are really not supposed to meet. You know, the strict wall of separation between church and state has gone, I think, even
farther than
Jefferson intended at the beginning.
I'm sure it has. Because religion is the source of truth. It's the source of practice, as McIntyre would have us understand that word. It's also, the primary stream from which we drink tradition, with both a small t and a capital T. Because of the set of knowledge and understandings and faith it brings, it's indispensable. it to as a contribution to human flourishing and therefore the common good and the good of all men.
Yeah, and religion informs and provides a set of first principles upon which I think our laws and jurisprudence can be built. You know, going back to Aristotle and St. Thomas Aquinas, no real study, no real sphere of knowledge rests on its own first principles. You know, you don't develop first principles of a particular science from within that science. That becomes circular, and so you have to go. You have to go outside what you're studying to get the starting point of what you're studying, and and so, you know, law and jurisprudence and things like that, like it or not, draw their first principles from certain religious beliefs that we hold in common as a people.
Correct. Yeah, so we're going to need, I can tell already, Mark, we're going to need our guest, which is going to be the Honorable Scott Cirque from Hancock County Circuit Court, to join us here in the Catholic Cave so that we'll be able to unpack that a little bit. Because, again, getting your point or the example about Sunday sales, yeah, it's hard to – I've listened to a lot of other commentary here in Central Indiana on other programs about, well, how we did, you know, they offer literally, and this is what is frustrating to me, they offer no coherent argument, and they can't even imagine one that would stop, that would, why we would not want to sell cold beer on Sundays. And again, to what you pointed, it's because it goes back to having the Sabbath as a day set apart for God. And the issue with alcohol sales is that alcohol often is misused, and in as much as people get intoxicated, which is a what? Sin. So you prohibit something like alcohol sales because you're diminishing, it dampens opportunities for grave sin to happen. Now, that doesn't sit well with a lot of Americans these days, because it's kind of like, well, what are you know, who are you to control me? It's maximum choice. You know, I'm not hurting anyone if I'm drinking at home, watching the football game, blah, blah, blah. Well, you know what? Whether you sin publicly or privately, sin is still a problem and not good for your soul. So that's, I want to offer, that's for listeners, that's the argument as to why, because you prohibit something like alcohol sales on Sunday, because once you legalize it, it does two things. One, it automatically, once it's lawful, conveys a kind of approval, and secondly, the availability means that you will have more consumption of it. And quite frankly, that's the economic case for legalizing it, is they want to sell more of it. But that's going to lead to more drunkenness. And that's just going to be a statistical reality, I would say.
But you also bring up the counterpoint to that. As you say, a lot of Americans are going to have kind of problems and issues with that because we live in a pluralistic society. And what their argument is not everybody is Christian that would honor the Sabbath on a Sunday. So not only do we have you know, Jews and Muslims that honor a different form of Sabbath, but we also have a growing number of secular people that don't see the point of having a Sabbath day at all. And so the law has to be able to accommodate everybody and not carve out special protections for one religious group over another.
No, but the law can take into account culture and a shared sense of purpose and common good for majorities, and that's a principle behind democracy, would be my counterpoint to that. And maybe one other quick thing to say on that point would be, we do set, so I'll use speed limits as an example, right? We know that as speed limits on highways are increased, the number of fatalities increases with it. And so therefore, so one might argue, I would say, a similar argument to this legalization of alcohol sales is, well, you know, people should be able to, we shouldn't have any speed limits on the highway, because there are certain countries, I think Germany, Autobahn might be, and here in America, because people should just be able to drive as fast as they think is safe. And we don't do that. We don't do that because we recognize that statistically, people will drive irresponsibly fast. And therefore, since we have to share the roads, we impose speed limits. And I would say alcohol produces a lot of ills in society. Alcoholism is a plague on society, and it causes a lot of problems. And having a one day a week where you have some modest prohibition of sales, because you can still go to a restaurant and drink. I mean, so it's not like it's completely dry. But I would say that would, to me, is a reasonable damper, a dampening force on our general consumption of alcohol that brings with it ills, societal pathologies, the same way that reasonable speed limits govern our behavior on shared roads.
Yeah, I don't know.
And so there's my argument.
Yeah. I would also.
I might be the only one that offered one so far in this whole debate. So there it is, folks.
Yeah, and I would also argue that the state has an interest in cultivating cultural institutions outside of the government. You don't want right and wrong solely coming from the government and judges.
That's Dr. Sam Gregg's argument, right?
Exactly.
You need mediating institutions.
You need other institutions, and one of those is religion. And so I do think the government has a sort of interest in doing what it can to encourage people to go to church on Sunday. And that's that really is the main point behind the Sunday alcohol sales laws, is to try to encourage people. We do live in a majority Christian
correct
culture.
Yeah. So that's our shared in this country, that's our shared value system.
Exactly.
Whether you're Christian or not, this is the common framework from which we have agreed to live by.
Yep, and the way to deal with people who have other religious traditions that celebrate the Sabbath on other days is to make accommodations for them to help the rest of us, I guess, sort of help them honor the Sabbath on their Sabbath days.
Well, I would say yes, and I would say also because this is a democracy, because we enjoy the privilege of freedom. You might a couple of examples I'll throw out there quickly would be, one, think about Utah, which is overwhelmingly Mormon, and they have very strict alcohol sales in the state of Utah as a result, including every liquor store is owned by the state of Utah. Think about that. Then you go right next door and you have Colorado, and you have something quite different going on there.
Right.
with what? They've legalized marijuana, and guess what? It's doing all kinds of crazy things. Raising of tax dollars. That's sort of the first thing if you're sort of pro marijuana. That's where you're going to go. But you may want to just kind of Google images of Colorado Springs and look at the skyrocketing homelessness of young people that are now frequently and habitually using marijuana, who are unemployed. Now unemployable in this condition, and living off the taxpayers' dollars,
right?
And robbing themselves of a future.
And that's
another reason to be very cautious about legalizing that stuff.
Right, and of course, you know, that was a democratic reform, so that came about because the majority
the same
of
kind
citizens,
of mechanisms. That's
right. The majority of the citizens within Colorado voted for that law. So there's an interplay to a certain extent between, you know, the democratic law and then families and religious institutions and how all of that plays. So we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to bring Judge Cirque in, and we can continue our discussion a little bit more about law, religion, Catholicism, society, and all the rest.
Think of all the media our young people are exposed to today. MTV, movies, what passes for entertainment on TV, song lyrics that are questionable or worse. Where do they hear the message that it's okay to be chaste and modest, or that it's not crazy to practice their faith, or to believe in a God who loves them and can forgive them no matter what they do? Catholic Radio is the answer. Be sure to tell your friends and relatives about Catholic Radio Indy.
If it wasn't for you all, I don't know what I would do.
Catholic Radio Indy.
What an absolute blessing you are.
If your lawyer's sleeping, better give him a nudge. Everybody look alive, because here comes the judge.
And welcome back to the Catholic Cave. We are thrilled and delighted to welcome into the cave the Honorable Scott Cirque. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Tim.
Great to have you, Judge. And you are the judge of the Hancock County Circuit Court, if
correct.
I've got that right.
Correct.
Well, thank you. We are in desperate need of your expertise and help here in the cave as usual. So we are eager to get your insights and perspectives around the law. And its purpose, and there's so many in our current setting. There's so many interesting cases that have been decided recently. We're going to take some time, I think, over the next little bit here to kind of unpack some of those. But tell us a little bit for our listening audience. Tell us a little bit about your background. How did you determine to become an attorney and practice law? And what are some of the positions that you've had along the way?
Okay. I've always been interested in law and politics. I come from a great family of history teachers, and I wanted to do something different. And if you go to college and you have a degree in history, political science, or something like that, you either become a lawyer or a teacher. So
there you go. Fine. So, right, same with a philosophy degree.
I was going to say, some of us wind up on the radio. So.
Yeah.
Philosophy, too.
Right.
I was at a committee of judges not too long ago, and somebody had a voice. They graduated from DePaul University with a voice degree, and they go, when are they going to start law school? So those are the type of things that you do. But I've enjoyed being a lawyer. I've been a lawyer since 1988. Started as in general practice. Also was a public defender. In 2002, I was the chief deputy prosecuting attorney in Hancock County, served that for 4 years. We lost re-election. I went back into private practice. I went from being thinking every day, what do I need to do to keep the people of Hancock County safe, to the very next day thinking, what do I need to do to make money?
Right.
That's the difference between
bills.
Private practice to
to
working for the government. And then in 2009, after 2 years as a public defender, and private practice, I became the court commissioner of Hancock County. Served that until last year when one of our judges resigned, and Governor Holcomb appointed me to finish the term. And so I'm currently doing that as the Hancock Circuit Court.
Well, that's fantastic. What is it about? You and I had met for
sure.
Full disclosure, at Daily Mass.
Yes.
So both of us said that. So I know you're someone who takes their Catholic faith seriously. So let me just zoom out a little bit. We're very interested in this program about kind of first principles and foundational ideas. Tell us a little bit about how you have sort of reconciled faith and reason, because so often it seems as if faith is positioned as if it's antithetical to reason.
Yeah, and not just...
And nothing could be further
right.
from the truth.
And not just faith and reason generally, but I think faith and American jurisprudence.
Yes.
You know, I think a lot of people look at that and say, you're not supposed to bring your faith to the courtroom. You're not supposed to bring your faith to the legislative assembly. You know, that's something you got to leave at the door.
Yeah, because we're not a theocracy, right?
Exactly.
That's what they're going to say.
When you walk in, you're no longer Catholic, you're American. And being Catholic and American somehow in a lot of people's minds...
Are incompatible.
Somewhat incompatible, exactly.
Well, my first thought when you said that is faith and reason. I believe there was a book a few years ago by Michael Novak with almost that title, saying how they are united in actuality. And I think that was part of the theme of John Paul II. Then going into what you were saying about the law and our faith, I do think, like Justice Scalia, one of the greatest justices of the Supreme Court, very intellectual, great theory, devout Catholic. But he always said he decided the law separate and distinct from his Catholic faith, but his Catholic faith enthused him or was totally, wholly part of him. So I think that's how I would say the distinction, if it can make sense. Faith and reason are united if you actually approach them together and intellectually, as John Paul II greatly taught us and others. But we have to, the law should be decided the same, whether you're as devout a Catholic as Scalia, or you're an atheist, or you're Jewish, or what, or Protestant. You decide the law based on the disciplines of the law and the facts. But, you know, if you know the Catholic thinking, way of life, the belief, the life system, it will come through as well. But there's a slight distinction there, if I can make that point. But so.
Well, I think that's very helpful. I mean, I really appreciate you bringing up Justice Scalia as an example, a contemporary example of someone who, as you said, is a devout. He was a devout Catholic. His son's eulogy, if you get a chance to watch it on YouTube, yeah. Father Paul Scalia, remarkable, just a remarkable. And there you can see, the impact that he had. I thought with Scalia, one of the things that I admired, and I'll defer to you as the expert, but he always seemed to, one of the things about the Catholic intellectual tradition as it pertains to law writ large is the natural law, right? And he would make use of and appeal to. How do you understand what the natural law is? And does it have any sway in jurisprudence? Or do they even talk, outside of Catholic universities, does it even come up, do you think, in like law schools anymore? Because I don't think it does.
They've stopped. They used to teach the law based on the natural law. They stopped that. In fact, I think when Justice Thomas was being confirmed for the Supreme Court, he speaks to the natural law as the guiding force. And I think it was then Senator Biden, future vice president, said, no one has that view of the law anymore. In truth, it is the best way to view the law, the natural law, in that the law is part of how we are as people, and it is defined first and foremost by the most important question, whether you believe in God or not, and it flows from that point going forward. And then there are certain things that all fit together with that, and that they all point to eventually the loving Creator that we have. And that's part of the natural law and how it should be applied. And I think we've gotten away from that. We've secularized it too much. Something similar you mentioned in your previous question, the separate between law and faith. And in actuality, just like everything, the answer to like another thing John Paul said, the answer to everything is Jesus Christ. And that's also the same thing in the law. One point I was going to say, though, when you mentioned Father Scalia, his son, and his eulogy, I listened to that. I thought that was another one of those moments that we're having periodically where Christianity and Catholicism is like a shining light in the darkness of secularism, and that right. was one of them. And when he got up there and said, I'm going to talk to you about a controversial man today, Jesus Christ, at right. his father's funeral, I mean, that was a stunner, and that's what he did.
Yes.
He made it about Christ, and
he had that opening, just as you said.
He had that opening. That just
totally hooked me, yeah. And he's like, yeah, controversy over here, and, one controversy brought us all here, and you're thinking he's talking about his father.
And he was talking about Christ.
And he was talking about Christ,
which
yeah,
which is
exactly.
just how Justice Scalia would have wanted it, and that's how he raised him. So, and the importance of that goes to another point the importance of fathers. I see that so much in the law. Mm. The main reason we have juvenile crime is every one of those, 90% of those juveniles that come before me do not have a father figure. There's no Saint Joseph in their life, and they don't even know what that is.
Isn't that one of the saddest that people, now we're so far, we're at least two generations now, right, into rampant divorce and the destruction of the family. People don't even know, some of the students I teach, they don't even know what family life is. I mean, they have no experience of it themselves, And they don't even have relatives. That they don't have, like, cousins to go, oh, well, over at, you know, Uncle Joe and Aunt Mary's house, it's so different, you know. Because all of the families have been destroyed in their entire sort of immediate social circle. And that leads to pathologies, and ills, right?
Oh, yes. When I talk to them, I say something like this. I say, if you had the father I had, you being here would be unacceptable. I realize that not all of you do. And I also say that men cannot be leaders until they're first a follower. You have to find another man that you follow. We all should follow Christ first. But I don't get that specific as a judge. But then I always tell them this. I say, I'm 56 years of age. I go, is that old? And all the juvenile delinquents always go, oh, man, that's old.
Doesn't sound too old to me, though.
But
I'm right behind you.
But I then say, if you ask me what resource we've lost more than any other in the United States of America, it's men.
Yeah. I would totally agree with that.
We have plenty of boys, very, very few men. Boys your age, my age, older, in between. And boys do what they want, when they want, with their only concern for their own pleasure, no concern for their family or community. They're only sorry about it after they get caught.
Right.
Men are the exact opposite. Men sacrifice their pleasure for the betterment of their community, their families, and others. We don't need another boy in Hancock County or in Indiana. We need a few good men. So I try to stress that, and I think that's something that we've lost. We've lost in the culture, and we've lost in our families.
And I think that goes back to the question we kind of brought up of the compatibility of faith and reason to a certain extent, because a lot of people look at the traditional family, you know, husband, wife, only kids from husband and wife, and they see this as a religious institution. They see marriage as a religious issue. And secularly, it doesn't matter how you live your life.
There's all kinds of combinations.
And lots of different types of families. Right, all of them are good. All of them go together. How do you answer that question? You know, is the family at its heart a religious institution? Or is there a more, I guess, social and cultural component to it that's important and intrinsic to American life?
My first answer is it's both. The family is both, similar to the law. It should be a religious, you know, that should be where you learn the faith the best. It's also like the key to whether a student's going to succeed in school is whether or not his family places emphasis on education. I'd say the same thing about your faith. That's the key. That's the starting point. But then also, it imposes very important social reasons, and that's something of, now going back to Justice Scalia, that's some of his point in his dissents to these cases that have brought about homosexual marriage, saying that that's equal to traditional marriage. His dissent was consistently the state has an interest in keeping the family as it is, as a unit. The state has an interest in that, and going against that has no basis in law. And that's one of the points he made, and I think that's something we're seeing. However, also with that, I do want to say this. I think part of the reason why we've lost the culture wars, when we grew up, we had a Christian culture, but it was very judgmental. And I think that's one of the keys. We're of the Pope John Paul II generation and Pope Benedict. But one of the keys that Francis brings us is in approaching the new world, he said, or the new culture, he says, do not judge. Love first, do not judge. However, he does say there are certain rules that we should follow. But that love first, I think, people can't listen to you unless they know you love them. And we lost that. And then by that, we've now created this secular culture that is destroying our family and is doing it misinterpreting faith and Christianity.
Here's one of the things. That was excellent. Here's one of my observations. I wonder if you might respond to it. it's in that because of the family breakdown and because of, as Mark, you were talking about, there's all sorts of combinations now. So one of the things that homosexual unions bring with it is infertility by definition, right?
Yes.
Two men cannot have offspring naturally, no. And two women can. But there is a desire for children. And so as a result, you see increasing efforts for what? You have to kind of manufacture children, surrogacy. And so what I think, what comes along with that, which calls into question, you know, parenting and all that kind of stuff, is that is it the case that is it most of our laws kind of based on the assumption, rely on assumption that there's a mother and a father that have offspring,
yes,
that they're responsible for, and that's sort of built into the law already. But now, because who's technically the parent, three parent, four parents, because we're doing what? Well, there's one woman, and she provides sort of the womb and sort of a living incubator, who's carrying the egg from genetically from another woman, who's been who's been inseminated by the sperm of man, you know, D, but the real father of the two that are married, they're going to receive the child, is another man. And so those are wild combinations. But and because of these combinations, it seems to me that you then in terms of the law, you have to then shift the authority that parent and responsible parents would naturally have in a natural family setting into the courts,
yes,
to adjudicate.
Yeah.
So so that's my observation, is that there's increasingly we're going to have to abdicate the natural authority and responsibility of moms and dads into the court systems increasingly to adjudicate because of these really odd arrangements as a result of these kind of reproductive issues. And those decisions will flow over to or are at risk of what? You can have wide sweeping decisions that actually then blow back into the natural family setting, right?
That is an excellent point. We've lost, we go to the courts or the law to decide issues that used to be decided by the family.
Right.
Constantly.
See, you summed it up. You summed it up in 10 seconds. It took me 10 minutes.
No, you nailed it, Tim. The other thing, when you were talking about us moving to infertility and all, and which we are, it made me think, we are living in the garden today. The serpent is talking to us just as he did Adam and Eve. There's the reason we should follow God is and then what I think with that is Paul VI, Humanae Vitae. Mm. Humanae Vitae, he wrote in 1968, and what he said, he wrote, there was, then there was a total movement that with the pill and other things. I think there was even a recommendation to him in the faith that married couples may be able to do. And he said no. He said that too with the advice of Carol Votia, who became John Paul II. But he said no. And the words he wrote in 1968, he said, if we move to contraceptives, women will be treated more as objects. Abortion, mm-hmm, will increase. Pornography will increase. Mm-hmm. The family will be destroyed. And he was attacked. He was attacked. The church didn't even totally support him and that teaching. And yet that celibate priest, elderly at that time, was more accurate and more knowledgeable than the experts. And that has been, we either follow God's way in all things, sex, money, all things, or if we do it our way, it's a mess, and that's what we've done.
You know, Humanae Vitae came out of kind of a first principle that I think has gotten lost in the shuffle. I think even among faithful Catholics to a certain extent, but certainly within, I think, secular American culture, and that is that human nature is, to a great extent, fixed. It's not malleable. And a lot of what we're seeing, whether it's the whole surrogacy issue, contraception in a lot of ways is this way, is based on this idea that human nature can be kind of experimented on. And we can conduct social experiments on our fundamental institutions, whether the family, whether it's education. The way society is set up is something that we can kind of control yep. and manipulate and change and experiment with. And, well, this may work, this may not, but we got to try it to find out whether it works or not. You know, our system of jurisprudence comes out of the idea of, you know, we were endowed by our Creator with certain Excellent rights point. That are inalienable. So our jurisprudence comes from that same point. How do we get into this? I mean, how did we move from this idea that human nature is something that the law is supposed to protect to the law is to kind of adjudicate all these experiments that are going on with human nature?
My first response is the constant battle that we've had since the Garden of Eden. You have the serpent saying, don't listen to God.
Do what you want.
Do what you want. It's better. He's lying to you. Mm-hmm. He doesn't want you to be. So we've always constantly had that. And our cultures went up and down in response. You know, the French Revolution was really man control.
Right.
And yet we responded to that, seeing that that wasn't true. Prior to that, Jefferson and Adams and the founders of our government realized, they followed the great classical Montesquieu and those who said, just as you said, the Creator endows us with great rights, freedom, but it's through Him that we act, not separate from that. So you constantly got that battle. I think it became worse. And what we're still being affected by is the view of Marx and communism, which is really you have the Catholicism way of God first, and you have the Marxist way of man first, God's a liar, and that is constantly at conflict. And we're living through those days still, even though the Soviet Union. You know, we lived through the Cold War. Now we have a generation who can't even imagine that, but the fact that the Cold War ended without a shot being fired in anger, there was almost miraculous events throughout that caused that to happen. Mm-hmm. I mentioned John Paul earlier. The fact that you had John Paul and Ronald Reagan at the same time on board, and that's fascinating to me. I know I'm way off your point, but Stalin at the end of World War II with Roosevelt and Churchill, they said, should we involve the Pope? Roosevelt and Churchill and Stalin says, what divisions does the Pope have? Well, the Pope ended up destroying Stalin's empire.
Right.
Right. Yeah.
So it's, but there's always going to be that constant of you either trust God or he's a liar, and we have to make that choice. And, you know, I've rambled too much, but that's the key thing. He loves us so much, he gives us free will. It's like the prodigal son. You can choose.
And, but look how it might turn out.
But look how it might turn out. And the prodigal son. But then the great thing of that comes back is the prodigal son, he comes back and the father loves him.
The mercy.
But the good son, which we all are and our listeners are, we have to watch, because he's sitting there saying, how can you do this?
He gets almost resentful.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
We don't know if he comes to the party.
Right,
you know,
right.
And we want us all to be in the party, and the good son in particular. On that, I know I've rambled way too much, but when I was a public defender, before I'd been a prosecutor, and then I was out. While I was a prosecutor, Father Dave Hellman at St. Louis de Montfort gave a homily where he said a parishioner asked him to go to Westville to speak to her son who was in the DOC. So he did. And he said he's listening to him, and he said it hit him that the inmate did not know the prodigal son, so he told him that. He asked him if he knew it, and he said he didn't. And then he stopped at the point where the prodigal son, you know, he says, you're dead to meet his father, waste all the money, comes back home, and he stopped. He asked the inmate at DOC, he goes, how did you think the father acted? He goes, oh, he was mad. He didn't know unconditional love. Right. When I went back as a public defender those 2 years before I became a judge, I would ask people in the county jails that I went to, public defenders, that same question. And I would a majority, 60 to 75% of the people in our county jails do not know the prodigal son. They don't know the story. And then when I would tell that to him and I would ask, how did the father respond when the son returned? An overwhelming majority of them said, oh, he was mad at me. He was mad. They don't know unconditional love.
That's a great example of what you were talking about earlier, of sort of what Pope Francis is urging us to do evangelically.
Right.
You know, that when we evangelize, it's not necessarily to beat people over the head with rules and the way that you should be living your life.
That comes later.
That comes later.
That comes later, yeah.
You need to make sure that they understand the prodigal son, forgiveness, you know, God's unbounded mercy for us.
See, that's what, and I hate to say it in this term, but that's what our enemies in the culture are doing. They're saying, we love you, we love you, love you. And they don't, meaning us, they don't love you. We have to we have love. We have to convince the culture we love them. And then they can listen and know and have the knowledge, because the facts are on our side. The law, the philosophy, the great logical thinking's on our side, not on the atheistic.
We have to open them up to it.
Yes.
Is what you're saying.
We
right.
have they to can't, open it up.
They can't hear.
They can't hear
it. And they,
until they know they're loved.
Until they know they're loved. That's such an excellent point. You know, unfortunately, we've got to have you back really soon.
Well, I'd like to come back. It was an honor to be with you guys.
Well, we'll take a bit of a break, but we'll be right back on the Catholic Cave.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy.
I'm just a bill, yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while I'm sitting in committee, but I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will, but today I am still just a bill.
Welcome back once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm still here as far as I know. And
we've not been arrested.
We've not been arrested. So I'm Mark Tuttle here with Timothy O'Donnell. And we just got done talking with Judge Scott Cirque. We've been talking about law. We've been talking about family. We've been talking about natural law. We've been talking about evangelization. We covered a wide variety of topics there.
Yeah, that was really enjoyable. That's the first time he's been a guest on the show, and it's, boy, what a real pleasure. I can't wait to have him back again, because we didn't even get a chance to start talking about some of the cases that are out there, you know, that have resulted in things like so-called same-sex marriage and things. Like, how did we get to that point? So we got him back, but I really appreciate, though, his perspective that he taught as he, I mean, as a prosecutor, public defender, private practice, and now as a judge, his insights into the breakdown of the family, which you and I have talked a lot about on the show over the years, and then he's seeing it firsthand.
You know, he's seeing a process that was described in a book by another past guest that we've had, and we've got to get him back, Patrick Deneen.
Yes. In his new book, yeah, right, Why Liberalism Failed.
Liberalism Failed, exactly. And what his point there is that as liberalism has advanced, it's eroded away all these other institutions.
Yes.
So families, churches, all of the institutions that used to help moderate right and wrong, those have gone away in the mm-hmm. in the marketplace of ideas. And what's happened is we've turned more and more to government, to the courts,
yes.
and had to rely on law to intervene in what really used to be a matter of just sort of public morality. So you used to have dads that would take people by the ears and say, you can't do that, son.
Right.
And as Judge Sirk was pointing out, those people are no longer around. Those fathers a lot of times are absent. And so what we're having is we're having basically law and courts having to step in and play roles that they were never intended to play.
That's right. And I think we all, and we're probably asking too much of our legal system, right, to step in and do that. I mean, without fathers, and I would say with the secularization of society, our common framework for living together is really crumbling, I would say. Because if you and I, Mark, were fathers raising families, and we're next door neighbors, and you and I generally have the same set of common values, then when my children are and I'm at work or I'm in the house or whatever, and you see my children doing something out of bounds, you would step in knowing that you would have my support to correct my children and vice versa. So and so there was this common sometimes it's called the mayor of the neighborhood, right? Sometimes would be what, like this elderly Italian woman, right?
Right.
But she knew the rules of society, right? And she knew, and she'd call. So in fact, it's Father Sirico used to tell the story of his growing up in Brooklyn, where that's exactly was it. You know, the boys would all be out there playing, stickball or something like that, and boys unsupervised can't of a certain age group. Well, we can get pretty riled up and shoving and hitting each other with sticks and fights break out.
Not boys, no.
And so she would be there, though, kind of watching and letting boys be boys. But then there's, of course, boundaries. And that's the thing. Without fathers, we're asking too much of, a single parent to on their own to be you look at all the social outcomes. Just very, very daunting task. I mean, we know from all the social science, from our faith, all the evidence points towards the best outcomes for children are what? When you have a mother and father, man and woman, married, committed relationship, raising their offspring is. And now I get everyone can't fit into that mold, but we need to have that as the shining ideal and move as close towards that as we can, and not just throwing it all up for grabs.
Right. And how do we move towards that? Because you brought up the fundamental problem there that you and your next door neighbor now
don't see eye to eye at all.
Come from very different places, come from different family backgrounds, come from different geographic locations.
Right. I'm one of those kooky Catholics, and they might be an atheist.
Exactly.
Right? So we don't even have the first most important question answered in common.
Right. And how do you get those questions answered in common? You have to have shared institutions that both of you take responsibility for.
Correct.
So you have to have schools that both of you see you've got a vested interest in. Where parents are involved, and you guys are the ones that are collectively making the decisions of what's taught and what's not. You have to have a kind of shared commercial environment where all of the shopkeepers, all of the store managers are all kind of seeing eye to eye on what's acceptable, what's not, and they're keeping an eye out for one another because they know each other. There's a community there. And so all of these community building aspects of society, we've got to take it upon ourselves, I think, to do our due diligence and probably to go above due diligence to work with our neighbors, to reach out, to try to build those commonalities. And it starts, I think, exactly where Judge Sirk pointed out, to a certain extent with evangelization, to, introducing people to the what used to be common stock of the Judeo-Christian ethic of parables like the prodigal son or other stories like that that come from our Catholic background.
Well, just the loss of that could be the place to start, right? The common narrative has been frayed or fractured and many of the pieces discarded or thrown out, and we need to restore those. We need to retrieve and restore those. So I really did admire as Judge Sirk was talking about, just using a story like the parable of the prodigal son to people who haven't heard. It's such a powerful story and conveys truth. The truth of what? Human nature, sin, and divine mercy, right? That's powerful. That can be life changing.
You know, one of the large Protestant churches in the area is in the process of creating satellite campuses around the city. So they're spreading
church
out.
Planting. They're planting that, new. I've heard that. Yeah.
And so, you know, with that, there's a bunch of statistics that are thrown out there. And the statistic that shocked me that they threw out, you know, obviously with that, you've got rivalries. So if you're planting new churches in areas where there's already churches, you have to go and
competition.
You have to knock on the door and introduce yourself to the old pastor and try to kind of reassure him that you're not moving into his turf.
Yeah.
And one of the statistics they throw out to help with that is something like, it's like 15%, I think, is close to the number. Of people that go to church regularly in this city. It's a really, really low number of people that frequent the doors of a Christian church on a Sunday. And so
I had no idea it's that low.
It's very low, very
that
low.
That surprises me.
And so, you know.
And saddens me.
And so there's going to be a large population of people that have never heard the parable of the prodigal son.
Yeah.
You know, they've never heard any of the biblical stories that we grew up with. And those biblical stories, for the most part, they don't necessarily teach us right from wrong. It's not a stern God that they're presenting. It's a loving, merciful God that's willing to take us back in, that's willing to forgive us, that's willing to be there. All of the parables that Jesus taught are great starting points for introducing people to who God is if they've never encountered these stories growing up.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I also think it was something I was listening to a lecture on YouTube, and one of the points that was being made is that related to what you're pointing out, Mark, is that the change in curriculum, say at the high school, or maybe most even acutely recognizable at the college level, is a movement away from great books, right? A great book, so a classical liberal understanding where we're all studying generally many of the same great writers, the same great stories, the same great information. And now this particular lecturer was pointing out where he's extremely skeptical because as he looks at like people's resumes and things like that, and you see, he says, if I see a word followed by studies, I know they didn't get a good education, because it's gender studies, it's sociological studies, it's women's studies. Anything followed by studies, he says, is just simply a very watered down, kind of narcissistic waste of people's times, because we're not studying, according to him, these perennial truths, the things of enduring and lasting value, because they've been what? They've been labeled as they begin all sorts of horrendous labels. You know, Shakespeare is, of course, you know, arguably certainly one of the greatest writers of all time, certainly Western literature. But because he's a certain gender and of a certain skin tone, we must discard him as a part of some sort of a patriarchal domination, you know, and so dispense with him, and so we're not going to read Shakespeare anymore. We're going to go do some other kind of oddball studies.
You know, and even the purpose of studying the great works of the past has become altered and changed. This is another point that Patrick Deneen brings up in the Why Liberalism Failed. It used to be that you embarked on these studies, and universities were dedicated to the idea of teaching you virtue so that you could be free, so that you could understand freedom through restraint, through understanding your own limits, through understanding human nature, through learning what it is to be able to act rationally. Now it's exploration, and it's trying to
and experimentation
and get rid of all of the societal bonds that
That's the attack on human nature that you were talking
exactly.
about. Exactly. Oh, you know what the term for it was? I'm almost out of time. Have you heard this? I want to throw this in real quick because we don't have to do maybe a whole liquid modernity.
Right.
Liquid modernity, that we're, human beings are just plastic clay, if you will, that just can be molded into all any shape we want if we just have the technology and the will to do it.
Well, we'll have to talk about this, you know, maybe next week, maybe in a future show.
And that is all the time we have for the Catholic Cave this week. For Mark Tuttle, for Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, may God bless.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to Kent@CatholicRadioIndy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at CatholicRadioIndy.org.